Am I on? Thank you. Good morning. Happy Father's Day to the fathers in the room, and happy Father's Day to all of our fathers, whether they're still here or not. Probably one of the most important foundations we can get in any ethical training, right? So let's recognize that. Well, listen, I'm extremely humbled to be here, and frankly, I was quite shocked when John and Todd asked me to speak to you this morning. Almost as shocked as when Dr. Esterline asked me, a Catholic working-class kid from Pittsburgh, to join the board of the seminary. So life has all sorts of surprises for you. So I have no formal training in divinity or theology or religion per se, other than 12 years of Catholic education. And I, frankly, for as many years as I've worked sort of in the ethics field, I have no formal education in ethics and can't discuss Sir Thomas Aquinas or Kant or any of the other classical ethicists of the time going back to Socrates. But I think the reason that Todd asked me and the reason I'm here is I have had a very interesting career. 40 years of being in what I call the bad news business, starting out in law enforcement, working through corporate America, and then through higher education and currently in nonprofit. So we thought what might be interesting is to take, I think I have two sessions, which again sort of floored me. We're going to be here this week and next week. And today I thought I'd talk a little bit about my law enforcement background and sort of my perceptions and observations in that role, and then corporate America. I spent 27 years, 8 years in law enforcement, and then 27 years in 3 different Fortune 500 companies in investigations, corporate security, ethics, and compliance. And then finally, at the end of my corporate career, I was recruited to go to Penn State after the Sandusky, what I call the Sandusky unpleasantness, to start an ethics and compliance office there. And I did that for 5 years, and then just 6 months ago, at the end of 2018, I was asked to step in as interim CEO for an organization called the U.S. Center for Safe Sport in Denver, Colorado, which was formed after all the sexual misconduct scandals in Olympic sports. So I've been doing that for the last 6 months, back and forth between Denver and Pittsburgh, and I'm happy to announce that tomorrow I will name my successor as CEO of that center, and I'll be happily returning to Pittsburgh in a much more quiet retirement in the next couple of weeks. So again, thank you all for being here. And with that as a background, I'd like to get in the Wayback Machine, starting, you know, I'm getting up there. And I started my career in 1978 in the district attorney's office. And it was an interesting time in Allegheny County. And many of you I see are somewhat of my vintage, may remember some of the events of the day. There was a scandal in the mid-1970s in the district attorney's office. And you all remember our neighbor, Tony Grosso, and a number of the folks surrounding that matter. And there was, you know, it's interesting when you look back on it that today, most of what Mr. Grosso, and continues to this day in the criminal world, is now legal, right? We not only have the lottery since those days, we now have legalized sports betting, which was the basis of that enterprise. But the real problem with that enterprise, and the real problem with sort of victimless crimes, is the corruption potential. And that's exactly what happened in those days, if you'll recall. Mr. Grosso had bragged that he had the state police in his pocket, and there subsequently was a number of state police officers who were indicted. And the district attorney at the time, Mr. Dugan, was ultimately charged. And the day he was charged, he was found dead at his Ligonier estate, his family's estate, committed suicide, quote-unquote, with a shotgun that was found about 8 feet from his body. And the investigator said, "You can't kill yourself with a shotgun with your shoes on, because the barrel was too long." And you know, as an aside, he would have had to use his toes to pull the trigger. So with that as the backdrop, I came out of Penn State, and the district attorney's office had been reformed. The county detectives at the time were fired, and a new DA in 1976, Bob Colville, took over. And the principal charge for him was honesty and integrity in the office, and to restore that in law enforcement. So Bob hired one of his former city police fellows, a man named Ralph Jovetic, with a single goal of bringing the most honest investigators you could find from the city police, and then hiring some young, more highly educated specialists to set up largely a government corruption and white-collar crime unit. So it was an interesting group. It was salty old police detectives, many homicide guys from the Gene Kuhn era of Pittsburgh police, and then young people, CPAs, lawyers. Many of us lost students, we had one guy who was the head of the tax practice at Arthur Anderson. And so it was a really interesting dynamic going back and forth. But the key was, it was white collar and political corruption, and the street crimes, the property crimes, were mostly delegated into the county police at that time. It's morphed a bit since, but it was a small specialty group with maybe 15 detectives. So that was sort of my introduction to ethics and honesty in government. And it was a time when there was also a lot of racial problems in Pittsburgh. And so I went through the police academy at the time, and Pittsburgh was under a court order for equity in hiring. And so my police class was, it was a city police class, even though I was a county detective, and it was 40 city police cadets. And under the court order, there had to be 10 black males, 10 white males, 10 black females, 10 white females. And then there were two of us who were outliers. I was from the county, and then a wonderful gentleman named Walter Waters was the chief of police at the University of Pittsburgh Police Department. So we went through the class together. But the reason I tell you the story is that within 5 years of my going through the police academy, and I counted this, I actually had my old class picture out, 10 of those officers were arrested criminally. I don't mean sanctioned, I don't mean they were, you know, had a disciplinary problem. They were criminally charged with offenses, two of them with homicide. And it wasn't a racial thing. There was one of the white officers, males, was charged with homicide on duty. One of the black officers, male, was charged with off-duty homicide. And it was just astounding to me that people who were drawn to, you know, it seems to me, would have been drawn to public service and have an ethical core would have been so off-kilter. Now, maybe that was a real outlier, and that has never happened with another police class, but it was just something that occurred to me as I thought back on those days. So I spent 5 years in that office, and the first thing we worked on, again, to look at the sort of the dichotomy with, was a scandal, a federal government scandal, the manpower scandal. Some of you may remember this. It was basically a ghost payroll scandal. There were federal funds available, and there was an organization set up in Allegheny County to provide lower income and disadvantaged people with employment. And with unchecked government dollars, they set up this massive fraud where they created these ghost jobs for literally dozens and dozens and dozens of people, including a number of the Pittsburgh Steelers, then the Super Bowl champions. And so it was a highly politically charged crime. But again, the reason I bring it up is that it occurred to me at the time and to this day, why people drawn to do the good that that program was set up to do, and they did do, also saw fit that they just figured it was okay to just set up, you know, several, you know, 150 ghost jobs and enrich their friends and get kickbacks from their friends for setting them up. So I'm not sure what that says about ethics or morality or sin or good or evil, but, you know, as I think through these things, it's really hard to define, sort of categorize good people and bad people. And I spoke to a graduating class a few weeks ago, and I said, you know, what have I learned in 4 years of doing this kind of work? And one of it is that people are people. And, you know, good people do bad things. And I've come away, in spite of this experience, most people are good. And we'll talk a little bit about what drives people to do some of the things they do and some of the psychology behind it. And my perspective has always been more of the same as you, sort of a Christian background, right, wrong, sin, good, evil, as opposed to the academic approach to, you know, the psychology and why people do things. So anyway, it was an interesting time, and I had aspirations to move to the FBI when I was an undergrad at Penn State. My undergraduate degree is in law enforcement from Penn State. During my time at the DA's office, I went to law school and with the principal idea of going to the FBI. So I did that and ended up only staying 3 years, but it was an interesting experience as well and sort of added to my education, if you will, in the conduct of people. The FBI Academy is an interesting place. It's like most, I guess, military boot camps and so forth, there's a tremendous amount of artificial pressure that when you're done, you realize none of that really mattered. There was only three things I had to do to get out of this place, but they put the pressure on every day, and it was mostly probably a third classroom, a third physical training, running, fighting, shooting. I mean, running and fighting, and then the third was shooting. So you had to do those things, and there were periodic tests you had to meet in each of those areas. And we had, again, people, you know, respond differently, and I guess that's why they stage it this way. We had two people thrown out of that class for misconduct. One fellow, a sergeant from the Detroit Police Department, I understood later that he had originally been caught cheating on an academic exam. But then in a meaningless firearms test, you got your main credentials with a, in those days, a revolver. You had to get a certain score. But you also scored with shotguns at the time. And a fellow was caught needlessly poking holes in his target with a pencil after the test. And it literally did not matter. He could have missed the target entirely with a shotgun from 25 feet, and he would have still graduated. But the pressure on people to do things, I guess it reveals character is the point. And one lesson of that was, nobody disappears you faster than the FBI. We were in class, an academic class, following the range exercise, and a supervisory agent came in and pointed to this guy, went like this, and he left the room. And not only did we never see him again, his room was cleared out, cleaned, and like no one had ever been there. It didn't exist. And I don't know that anybody ever kept in touch with him. But it just, again, the dichotomy or these binary feelings of people. You know, he's drawn to public service. He was a police officer. He wants to go to the FBI, which does a very good background check on character. And again, just a judgment like that and responding to the pressure in that way. FBI, interesting place. So, one of the lessons that they teach you there is the importance of informants, right? So, I've always had problems with undercover operations and informants. When I was with the county detectives, and one of the things that, I was with the county detectives. We had an undercover operative in a location in West Mifflin. And this fella had identified a series of thefts that were going on. These were oxygen and compressed air cylinders they were selling on the black market. And so they came to the DA's office. We set up a sting operation. He had arranged to sell a massive amount of these compressed air canisters. So we all, a bunch of us, went out sort of undercover for the day as his henchmen loaded up all these canisters. And when we were about to drive the trucks away, we had support come in and we arrested everybody at the site. And it leads me to another one of my conclusions, or maybe some on the same theme, that I liked the people we arrested a lot more than I liked the guy who was the undercover operative. He was a private sector guy, and the point of an undercover operation is to engender trust among the people you're working with, and then ultimately betray that trust. And I've never been very good at that, and so I just found the people that could do that, you know, not the kind of people I wanted to spend time with. But the working class people we arrested, it was really kind of a shame because they were just hardworking people trying to make a few bucks on the side. And in many of these cases, you can see they put the bad they were doing, the criminal event of theft, aside from, this is a multinational, gigantic, several billion dollar corporation. I'm a poor guy struggling to make ends meet. What's a few canisters? You know, so one of the keys in most crimes we'll talk more about is the ability to justify it. Nobody wants to be evil. Nobody wants to be bad. So a key thing, and one of the things we talk about in interviewing, is the ability for someone to justify the bad acts they're about to do, in spite of that. The theme that runs through many of these things is just the ambiguity, you know, who the good guys are, who the bad guys are. But anyway, back to the FBI. So all shiny new FBI agents go up to meet the director, right? And at that time, it was Judge William Webster. And Judge Webster, you know, we have this, the class was in his big giant office, and we're talking to him, and someone said, "What's the most important thing you learned in the FBI coming from a federal judgeship in St. Louis, Missouri?" And he said, "The importance of informants and how it's unbelievable what percentage of our cases get solved by people reporting on crime. That it's not old-fashioned police work, it's not digging through things, it's the simple fact that someone comes forward and speaks." And it was an interesting message, and it became one of the themes that they pushed in the FBI, which was to develop informants, and not just the guy on the street selling you the watches out of his pockets. You know, they encouraged you to go to banks and schools, and you literally had part of your timesheet. You had to talk about how many hours you devoted to informant development. And informant's sort of a scuzzy word, but it was people like all of us, right? Normal middle-class people in the community that would have knowledge of something that might help them lead to a crime. So lead to a conviction of a crime. So it was, again, just sort of that ambiguity between good guys, bad guys, honest citizens, and how that all comes together to make these things work. I can editorialize a little bit about J. Edgar Hoover. You can't resist, right? J. Edgar Hoover, what a giant of a person. And I've read a lot of the books and haven't seen all the movies, but you know, we know the controversy around him, and he clearly had some interesting quirks as an individual, but is largely credited with inventing modern law enforcement. And one of the things that people don't know is the way he did that was basically through the use of library skills. Before Mr. Hoover went to law school, which is no FBI agent ever calls him anything but Mr. Hoover, past, present. 19 years old, Mr. Hoover came out of secondary school and became a clerk at the Library of Congress and was a runner, had to deliver books and restock books. and learned the Dewey Decimal System. And so when he was recruited or went to the what was then called the Bureau of Investigation as a young executive and rose quickly through his intelligence and frankly his ruthlessness and street smarts, he brought the Dewey Decimal System with him. And that was the basis of the beginning of the FBI record system. He had every interview, in the pre-computer days, every interview you did, you filled out a number of cards, or a clerk did actually. An agent would come back with interview notes, and a clerk would write a card on it, Regis Becker, address, associates, known jobs, all that. And then each one of those would be cross-referenced on another card, Regis Becker. Then there'd be a card that said PPG. He worked at PPG. And it was a giant card system. So every lead that an agent would get, he'd send a note out to all the affiliated field offices, and they would check their card files and come back with all the information. It was the first organized effort to really track not only crime and witnesses and criminal associates, but all the proper nouns associated with that individual. So it was, I just wanted to pass it on as a side. It was an interesting start. And of course, the fingerprints followed suit shortly thereafter with the National Fingerprint Registry that has become so critical, and now the DNA National Registry, the forensics. But it all started with Hoover as a runner at the Library of Congress restocking books and learning the decimal system. Law enforcement is when you're a young kid, you know, it's a glory bound, sexy occupation. I wanted to arrest bad guys and kick doors and, you know, be a tough guy. And I did that for a number of years. But it ultimately wears on you. And law enforcement is a very stressful, as you all know, you may have been in law enforcement or friends in law enforcement. It sort of wears you down emotionally. And I found myself, after just a few years in the FBI, hearing people talk, people that were 30 years old, talk about retirement. And police officers, the one thing you can always strike up a conversation with a police officer, and I did this as I traveled, frankly, all over the world doing investigations on the private side, was talk about their pension. Police officers are obsessed with their pensions. And the FBI was the same way. And so when I'd see 30 and 32-year-old colleagues and friends and agents talking about pensions, I thought, I don't think this is for me. Time for me to move on to something where more forward-looking to coming to work every day and doing some good. And I probably should have said earlier, I don't give myself, I'm not one of these politicians that talked about my life of service and I was always interested in helping my fellow man. It's just I always wanted to be in jobs that were consequential, that had important outcomes. And I've always admired my friends who, whether they sold paint or were entrepreneurs. Every job has dignity and nobility, but I was just always drawn to things that had, you know, the bigger questions, right, wrong, good, evil. So at the same time, the FBI was a terrific organization, but you get sucked into sort of the bureaucratic daily grind of reporting, and you sort of lose sight of the big, at least I did, the big reason why you're there, you know, to make an impact, to be consequential. So I started looking around, and remember the old West Mifflin undercover thing we did? That company, the Union Carbide Corporation, long since deceased, was looking for a special investigator. So they had reached out to me. I was in the FBI by now, and they hired me, and my new wife, Barbara, and I went off to Connecticut to work for the Union Carbide Corporation, then a Dow company, a Fortune 50 company, $10 billion in sales at the time. And it was right after Bhopal. And those of you who don't remember, Bhopal was probably still the worst industrial accident in the history of the world. Over 2,000 people were killed when a gaseous leak from the plant in Bhopal, India, killed these people. And it was a truly tragic situation. It was really my first introduction to corporate ethics and the way people respond to these tragedies. There was critics on both sides. It was an interesting time there. But essentially, Union Carbide's position was, would poison people with methyl isocyanate. It was a chemical that, when mixed with water, gases off into a poison gas. And in India, which was, as it is today, a very still poverty-ridden country, there were thousands of people living around the plant, literally, with lean-tos against the side of the plant, shacks set up all around the operation. So when this gas leak came out, it devastated this entire community, killing 2,200, 2,300 people. The position of the company, they brought in Arthur Young, an engineering firm, and did an engineering study and concluded that the only way this could have happened, because all the pipes were separate, the engineering drawings, was someone to take a hose and stick it in an air vent. And they had a suspect that they thought did that. But that was quickly lost in the politics and the horror of all these deaths. The Indian company owned 25% of the facility. They had designed and approved all the engineering and safety specs for the plant. But of course, none of that matters when you have a tragedy like this. It was all about the evil American corporation, you know, greedy, that didn't have the proper safety in place. So the thing that struck me about the whole story was, and it was before I actually got there, Warren Anderson, who was sort of an old line, waspy, you know, gray-haired, very, very turned-out CEO, a brilliant man, hard worker, and just the epitome of the American dream, did what any human being would do and responded to his emotions and went to Bhopal over the advice of the security department. He was immediately arrested, thrown in Indian jail overnight, and he knew that was a likely outcome, but he wanted to show the humanity and the care of the company. And it just struck me at the time, like, wow, this guy who's of a certain age and a certain power and all the things he could have done that would have been symbolically maybe not equal to, but showed the compassion and care of the company. And he got on an airplane and went there, and it was obviously a devastating outcome. They had to bail him out. He's dead now. There's still criminal charges that were pending for decades after he was in Bhopal. And interestingly, the case was solved, or the case was closed civilly, for $485 million, which doesn't sound like much money today. In 1986, that was a lot of money. It was after all the back and forth and diplomacy and negotiations, and I had this on very good authority, it wasn't publicly announced, Union Carbide hired Henry Kissinger and paid him $1 million for one day of work, which is good work if you can get it. And because he was Henry Kissinger, he could get in and talk to the right people, and he negotiated the settlement for $485 million, which was later overturned several times by Indian Supreme Courts, and the fight continued for years and years, but Union Carbide was largely off the hook. Anyway, that was the organization I headed into. It was in complete chaos. They were selling off divisions like crazy. They were being destroyed in the press every day. There were critics, but I worked there for about 6 or 7 years in as a special investigator, doing mostly white collar work. And white collar work's interesting, white collar criminal work, which is what I did at the district attorney's office, because again, you end up liking the defendants more than the victims in many cases, because the defendants are clever people with charisma and charm, and they talk to people and they engage them to give them money for various things. And in many cases, the victims are, I won't say dishonest, but they're looking for an easy buck, right? I can get 18% interest, really? And they're kind of greedy, and so they're easy marks in many cases to be sucked in. I remember arresting a lawyer not too far from here. Actually, we arrested him several times locally. At least twice, I remember. And this guy was you probably would know the name, I'm not going to say it. Fascinating, charismatic, friendly, very successful, an extremely successful legal practice and a sports agent. And at the time, I was playing some minor league football for the Pittsburgh Wolfpack, and he knew that. And so we have this guy handcuffed in the back of our car. We're taking him down for arraignment. And he starts trying to sign me as a client. I can get you a Canadian football contract. He had me go there for a minute. Yeah. I don't know if he wanted me to unlock him, but my point is that these guys are very, very often very charismatic, and it goes back to that whole ambiguity thing about good and evil and who's bad and who's good, and especially when there's these the victimless type crimes that are involved. The FBI, of course, was well known for bank robbery, right? The stupidest crime a human being can commit. The old Willie Sutton line that why do you rob banks? That's where the money is. It's just patently untrue. Banks, even 40 years ago when I was doing bank robbery cases, had cameras. So unless you're really clever at disguising yourself, and for the last 60 or 70 years, no teller drawer has ever had more than $1,500 or $2,000 in it. And so we would marvel at the people who would go rob banks. We'd arrest them within a day. It was a very routine crime. You would go to the bank, you'd respond, you'd interview the tellers, you'd get the information, and you would go to the development shop, develop the pictures, basically give them to the Pittsburgh robbery squad, who knew all the people, and they would go arrest them for us. And it had a federal charge. So if I robbed a Giant Eagle on payday, if I'm good at it, I'm likely, in those days, even get $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 cash, untraceable, with, in those days, no cameras, no dye packs, and I walk out of there with $30,000, free as the breeze. If I rob a bank, I'm going to get, in many cases, serialized bills that are tracked, a dye pack that's going to explode in my face and create weird paint all over the place, and my picture is going to be in every police station in the city. So, it wasn't exactly intellectually challenging work. But the FBI built their reputation, again, on statistics. And when they would go to Congress every year for funding, they would take their statistics. And in the old days, two of the big statistics were car thefts and bank robberies. And they cut their teeth on the John Dillinger, Pretty Boy Floyd stuff in the 30s, right? So it was a big part of the culture and history of the FBI. But in those days, it literally was the Wild West. There were no cameras, there were no dye packs, there were men with machine guns running around the Midwest robbing banks and killing people, frankly, fairly gratuitously. So it was a great thing that the FBI was doing because there was no coordination between law enforcement at that time. But by the 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s, when I was in the FBI, I don't want to say passé because you don't want anyone to rob banks, but it was usually low-level drug users that needed money quickly, that didn't give it much thought. You know, there's the old story about the guy who wrote the demand note on the back of his own deposit slip. True story. Like, so this wasn't exactly, you know, master criminals. And that's the kind of work I was doing. We were doing bank robberies. We were doing extortion. It was more property crime. And so, as I said, I determined it was really, you know, it was time to move on. And talk a little bit about fraud and, again, motivation. And I'm no psychologist. And, again, my observations are all personal, just what I've seen and my perceptions in working with people over 40 years, doing a lot of interviews, both witness and what we call subject interviews. And one of the tools, one of the things you keep sort of conceptually in your mind is called the fraud triangle, you know. And it's sort of pop psychology, pop science. But it really works. There are three things you really look for in these frauds, the pressure on an individual. You know, so do you have financial pressure? Are you a gambler? Are you a drug user? Do you have family problems, medical problems? And in some cases, you're just a bad person that wants an easy way to make a living. The opportunity, you know, which is one of the things that accounting is designed to eliminate, right? The controls and dual signatures and all the things we do. So opportunity is a big thing that corporations would focus on, reducing the opportunity to do that. And then most importantly, and I mentioned this before, the ability in your own mind to rationalize the crime and rationalize your behavior. And this is what, at least in my view, all the interview training I've been to and the people I've talked with, was what they'd focus on. When you do an interview, unlike on TV when the good guy berates the bad guy and calls him a scumball and you're going to go to prison, or he basically berates him until he confesses, never works in real life, of course. You have to make a connection, like we all do in any interaction with people. And the best way to make a connection with someone you're trying to get to make a statement against their own interest, if you want me to make a statement against my interest, and it's one that might put me in jail, you have to make it acceptable for me to view myself positively by doing that. And so this whole notion of creating a reason why you did what you did is huge in doing subject interviews. You really felt overworked, didn't you? Yes, the company's terrible. And my manager's really unreasonable, and they make me work weekends, and they get going on a whole tirade about why they're angry at whoever it was that was victimized by this. And you don't discourage that, you sort of encourage, is that right? And you're an honest guy, right? You work hard for a living, you deliver good value, don't you? Yeah, you get them going. And pretty soon they've got themselves convinced I was justified in doing what I did. And so you play that. I can see how that would happen. I can see how you could really feel that you were so put upon by the organization that this just seemed like the right thing to do at the time. And maybe you wouldn't do it again, but I understand why you did that. And then, you know, you work through that and you finally get to the point where you write a statement. And it's a little bit disingenuous, but it's not uncommon, certainly. And it's what all good interviewers do. The best interviews I've ever known have been people that are really nice people and know how to engage people. Because that's the key. It's getting people comfortable. They have, you know, we always have sort of the warm-up period. You talk about the person and get them talking about themselves. And the last thing you talk about is the crime or what they did. You talk about what you do for a living, your family, your background, sort of make them feel comfortable. And then you generally work toward this, letting them rationalize. You don't do it overtly to say it out loud, but you let them rationalize in their own mind why they did what they did. And then, of course, as all human beings, they look for what's in my interest here. What's going to be the easiest way for me to go in this setting? You know, is there enough to convict me if I don't confess? And they make those judgments. So it's just an interesting process. And it's all about building trust with the person and then honoring that trust. And you know, you can do that. So we talked a little bit about undercover work and just my general disdain for that kind of work. It's a difficult area. I've supervised a number of private sector undercover operations, and you know, some of them just break your heart. When I was at PPG, we had a big drug problem in one of our plants in North Carolina, and prescription drugs, and it was a very tough place to work, physically tough place to work. But we had lots of problems with medical issues. We knew there were doctors at pill factories in the area, so we put in three undercover operatives, and within 6 months, we had developed a mountain of evidence about use and distribution of Xanax and other muscle relaxants and that sort of thing. So we set up the whole sting operation for a Friday night. We went down there. We had the state police. We didn't even tell the police we were doing this until very, very close to the end because we just didn't trust the local authorities. So we worked with the DEA originally and then got the local police involved and made 47 arrests in a plan of, you know, maybe 600 or 700 people. It was just devastating the community, headlines in the local paper. And again, it was one of those cases that sort of broke my heart. We got, you know, kudos for it. It was a good operation. We did everything by the book. Most people pled guilty and moved on. But these were people that were honest, hardworking people and who literally were physically suffering. It was a plant where it was non-union, but they had voted themselves 12-hour shifts. And it was heavily physical work, pulling fiberglass through platinum rhodium bushings, you know, for 8 hours at a time, short breaks and so forth. So, you know, it was one of those things that, yeah, you did your job, but it didn't make me happy. And again, the people that were undercover, I just don't have that gene, you know, that to build trust with all these people, go drinking with them, engender these great relationships. They became fast friends with these people. And then, you know, a couple of them at the end wanted to watch us do the perp walk, which really, you know, I don't know, again, they're honest people, they're doing an honest job. We hired them to do the job. They did the job we hired them to do. But it was one of those things from an ethical standpoint. It just never really felt right to me. And they all lost their jobs. They, you know, 42 of the 47 pled guilty, and we moved on. It was a difficult place. We had a same location. We had a young man, the only, fortunately, workplace homicide I was ever involved in, a young man who had dwarfism, a very small guy. He was actually taking prescribed human growth hormone. He's maybe 20 years old, 5 feet tall, and he and his brother worked in our plant. And he was, of course, picked on and bullied by the workforce, and he was involved in some safety violations, and he lied about what he was doing, and he was eventually fired, and he was scheduled for a last chance hearing to make his case to try to be reinstated to work. And the night before the hearing, he went out to a pawn shop and bought a crappy old .22 caliber rifle and came back to the plant, and he waited for the guy who was going to testify against him, his former friend, to come out of the plant. He started talking to him about, you got to get me off the hook, you got to say this. And the guy said, I'm not going to lie for you, I'm going to tell the truth, I just want this to be done. And the kid implored him, and he didn't say he would do it. So the kid started shooting at him from the side of his truck. This guy ran, he missed him, and this was out in a parking lot outside a fenced area of the plant. And several of the bullets went into the plant, and one hit a guy right in the spleen and burst his aorta, and he died on the spot. And for years, I've had trouble telling this story without tearing up because it was so tragic. The guy who was killed was walking in with his arm around a younger guy. They called the guy Pops. And the younger guy was having a tough day, and I don't want to go to work, and this place sucks, and I hate this. And the other guy's, you know, bucking him up. Ah, come on, it's not that bad. Let's go. Bang, dead. And it just was so horrific. And the story doesn't end there. The young guy, the dwarfism sufferer, gets in his truck, races off. Our security calls the police. The police chase him down. They corner him police car's. He's up here. Police car's down here. He shoulders the rifle. The police tell him to drop his weapon. He refuses. And, you know, two, three times. I actually had the video. I had a copy of the video. I saw the video, the patrol car video. He refused. So the police shoot. Hit him right here. The bullet goes around. And a 40 caliber handgun, powerful, you know, handgun, semi-automatic. Goes around his skull, lodges in his larynx. And he not only lives, he resists arrest. He's wrestling with them as they try to handcuff him and take him to jail. Which the couple of interesting points there. One was that a crappy old .22 he bought for $100 in a pawn shop killed a man at 200 yards. And two, that a trained police officer, SWAT trained, hit him with a high-powered pistol right in the head, and he lived. God works in a serious way. So he was convicted but mentally ill, and he went away. But the whole thing was just tragic from start to finish. Not only, you know, he was the perpetrator, obviously, but you understood why he did what he did, and the, maybe not what he did, but how he felt to be such a victim in the whole matter. He was bullied. He was treated badly in the plant. He reacted. He made a mistake, and he thought the punishment didn't fit the crime, and it was just very, very difficult. So let me, I know some people have to leave soon. Let me just wrap up with my views on hotlines and anonymous reporting, which is just, and we'll talk more about this next week. Next week I'll talk about Penn State, talk about Center for Safe Sport. Hotlines are, you know, the media images that the put upon, and I sound so cynical to say this, the idealistic whistleblower that rides in on the white horse to save the company and report bad doing or save the enterprise. And I put my first hotline in 1999, and I've been managing hotlines, including the one I have now at the Center for Safe Sport, for, you know, what is that, 20 years now. And they're incredibly difficult. They're a good tool. They're absolutely essential. You have to have them, and they have to have an anonymity component. But they're very difficult to run, and so many of the people, and I say this with, again, 20 years and thousands of hotline call experience, so many times the calls are motivated to hurt someone you don't like in a facility or in a company, or to advance your own ends in some sort of intramural battle. Occasionally you get really, really good calls. You know, I've had a couple really unbelievably striking calls. We had one where a secretary called from a sales office and said, "You need to look at the expense reports of everybody in the sales office." She did it anonymously. We didn't know who it was. We just knew the plant and the salespeople. And it turned out to be a $450,000 accounts payable fraud that somebody set up, phony companies, was paying himself to Mexican suppliers that didn't exist, et cetera, et cetera. And just from that one little simple phone call, identifying nobody but a department, we made a huge case, criminal prosecutions, all that. Others were... There was one other I wanted to mention. Let me just find my notes here. It actually was less of a hotline call. It was a hotline call, but it was from a woman who was in a sales organization. And this was to the ethics committee, this got reported. And she was a young woman trying to make her way in an automotive OEM sales division, right, selling to the big three automakers, selling basically paint. And she said, "We have an unfair policy because all of our customers expect as part of their work to be taken to a strip club and entertained. I find that personally offensive, but my managers say if we don't do it, our competitors at DuPont and BASF will do it and they'll get the business. So it's impeding my ability to get on the big accounts and to be successful and to move up the chain." And so it was pretty much going to be ignored, I think, until I got it to the ethics committee. And our chairman at the time had two daughters who were just entering the workforce, the professional workforce, and it really resonated with him. And we had a big debate about how you address this. The first there was the business people. The ethics committee was people like me that were sort of staff that did the you know, lawyers and accountants and the compliance officer, and then others that were from business. We would rotate senior vice presidents of business through every 2 or 3 years. We would change the senior vice president so they all had exposure to the ethics committee and worked with us on this. And so they were making the case, not strongly, but arguing why the business unit wanted to do it the way they did. And we can't change the culture. We can't change people. We can't change what our customers are interested in. And the CEO was struggling with this and struggling with it. And finally, he said, "Well, let's do this to start. We're not going to reimburse any expenses from adult entertainment clubs." And he pointed to the CFO and he said, "You make sure that works." And he said, "You examine closely all these expense reports so they're not faking it and putting it down as a restaurant when it's this." And that was sort of an easy way out, but ultimately unsatisfying. And we ultimately changed it to ban all company support of any adult entertainment, and the culture slowly changing. Shortly thereafter, GM got sued in a massive sexual harassment claim, and there's been all sorts of problems along those lines. So it was one that had a good ending. And there are those that had a good ending. I could talk for a long time about hotlines and satisfying calls and unsatisfying calls and how people use them. But I know some of you have some choir practice to go to, and I want to leave a few minutes for questions if anybody had questions just about this part. I'm going to talk about some of this other stuff later. Next week we'll talk more about Penn State and Center for Safe Sport. Yes, John.
Regis, you may be aware that Westminster, right here, we had an incident where a trusted long-term get involved in this. Probably fit this individual. I don't have any inside information. I would very much encourage anybody else who has a reaction to what happened. But this was an individual. still is in many respects.
Right. John, you're so right, and you see it all the time. PTAs, Boy Scout troops, Little Leagues, single source person who takes the money in, pays the money out, no controls. They're good people. They work hard for the organization, and they borrow money. Borrow $150 because I need to do this. Hey, no one caught that. It almost inevitably starts with, they justify it in their own mind. I need to pay a bill. I don't have the money. They borrow it, and then the next time, you know, it's not noticed, and a month or so later, they do it again. And originally, I can't tell you how many times, originally they were always going to pay it back. And then they get caught up in it. We had one guy, corporate guy, who had the weirdest gambling problem I ever heard of. He did scratch-off tickets. And he literally sat in like a Sunoco parking lot for 6 hours one day, going back and forth, buying the tickets, scratching them off, putting them all on his corporate American Express card. Thinking, I'm going to hit big, I'll pay the company back. And it turned out to be nearly six figures that he cheated the company on American Express because he was addicted to these scratch-off things. I'm going to hit the big one. Another guy, same thing with he fell in love with a stripper and would charge all his lap dances and all his work to his American Express card, thinking, I'll pay it back. And it was over $100,000 at the end of the day. A rising star who had run an international division transferred back to Pittsburgh and was rising through the ranks. And this, you know, why do people, what was he thinking? You know, how do people justify this in their minds? But you're right, they do. And it's usually something simple when it starts. I can't tell you how many times people start out with this notion that, and sometimes even accidentally, they get away with something and think, I can do that. We had one woman did $2.2 million in duplicate invoices from shipping companies. And she managed to, you know, I think the first one was, we literally tracked it. The first one was, you know, $10,000, then $12,000, $24,000. You know, 47,000. Pretty soon it was hundreds of thousands of dollars because no one was catching it and the auditors weren't finding it. And early on, I'm sure she justified it, you know, I'll pay it back. And so Westminster is not unique. And as I said, the ambiguity, in my dotage, my wife will tell you, I've become drawn to these old Westerns where the binary lines are so clear. There's bad guys that wear black hats. There's good guys that wear white hats. And I love those shows because there's no ambiguity. My daily work is there's always this tug between good and evil, and a very good person does a very bad thing. We'll talk next week about Larry Nassar, the gymnastics doctor who abused all those girls. By all accounts, a wonderful man. Did wonderful work for these kids. They literally loved him. Their families loved him. And he was sexually molesting each and every one of them, you know, unbeknownst to them even. And so, this whole ambiguity between, you know, personality types, how they justify these things in their mind. But in any event, it's so comforting to me to know who the bad guys are, because so often in our daily life we just don't know that. Other questions? Anything else about it? Yes, please.
I'm curious, in your law enforcement work, if you were exposed to situations where, you know, there's a criminal who did an unethical thing, but then unethical things were done to bring forward evidence to convict the criminal, like, where you've got a battle of ethics on both sides.
Yeah, right. Yeah, it's. I never did, of course. but we all knew stories of certain police officers that would, you know, get so fed up with. In those days, it was only 10, 20 years after Miranda and Escobedo and all the Supreme Court cases that held officers to a much higher standard, evidentiary purposes, to make you prove the cases. You couldn't beat suspects anymore. You know, we would joke about the guys we worked with, the pre-Miranda cops who came on the job in the 1950s and had, you know, let's say a little more unorthodox investigative techniques. But there were certain officers who had a reputation for stretching the truth, and particularly with regard to confessions. We recently lost a guy in Pittsburgh who did not have that reputation, who was the best interviewer. I know his name's going to escape me. You'll know it as soon as I said it. But they used to joke about him because he was so good, and he was so good at building trust and getting confessions, that there was always, you know, some sort of jealous suspicion that he was lying on the stand about his confessions. But there were people who had the reputation of, and it's particularly easy in statements, right? It's harder to gin up physical evidence, but it's much easier to lie on the stand. The person either told me they did it or someone else told me they did it, and then you get a credibility issue with a police officer and a witness who's probably not you know, a very credible person who's done bad things, or a defendant who's done bad things. And so it becomes much easier for the police officer to win that credibility judgment in a court. And it's unfortunate because it undermines, you know, the whole trust in the criminal justice system. And you just hate to see that. You know, we've seen it recently with some of the things going, some of the political issues I won't touch on, but just even locally, some of the criminal conduct you see, just the lies people tell on both sides. And you go back to Tony Grosso, that was the problem. Undermining confidence in the criminal justice system by paying off police officers. And the police officers, obviously, we talked about justification. It's a victimless crime. Somebody wants to bet on the Steeler game, who am I to say they can't bet on the Steeler game? I'll take a few dollars not to talk about it. And now look at, you know, 50 years later, legalized gambling. Pornography used to be a criminal enterprise run largely by the mob. I don't know if anyone remembers the porn wars of the 1970s when Liberty Avenue porn shops were getting blown up. There was a Youngstown faction of the mob, there was a Pittsburgh mob, and there was some fights about control of a porn shop. I'm manning here, but just it's an interesting story. And now, today, 50 years later, porn has been democratized. Any 14-year-old on his phone can get porn that's 50 times worse than what they had in the Liberty Avenue porn mob-controlled porn shops, right? So, you know, it's sort of situational ethics. You know, then it was bad, it was criminalized. Now it's ubiquitous, just like gambling. And although illegal gambling is still illegal, but from a moral standpoint, it's hard to justify those things. And we're going through the same thing with marijuana and some of the drug crimes. Is it really worth filling prisons with people for abuse of marijuana or sale of marijuana? And now we're having that debate as a society. Yeah.
So you talked about something that I've been thinking about through a lot of your talk. And, you know, my reading of the Bible is there is no hierarchy of sin, right? Sin.
Right.
But what you were just saying is interesting because that does tend to say, you know, there is a line somewhere. I don't know how to write those things, and I know police officers on the beat doing traffic stops. You know,
right.
Judgment every day.
Right.
You know, how do you strike that?
It really is difficult, particularly in crimes that are, you know, man crimes, right? What was Joseph Stalin's head of secret police said? Show me the man, I'll show you the crime. And you can almost do that in the United States with the federal code. Federal criminal code would fill this room. I guarantee all of us have committed a federal crime sometime in the last week or two, literally with environmental crimes and everything else. So it really is hard. And so when you look at the morality of charging somebody with a crime, whether it's sports gambling or something else, it's just hard to get very excited about that, particularly when it subsequently becomes state-sanctioned and state-supported. So as a Christian, you know, I've always thought about it in those moral terms. And so the old Les Mis where... you know, Javert chases a guy for stealing a loaf of bread to feed his family for 40 years. You know, you understand his passion to do his job and his black and white reading of the law. But the morality of it is any of us would steal a loaf of bread to feed our family. My God wouldn't punish me for that. He should have found a better way to do that. But, you know, so I get your point. And it's very difficult. And in law enforcement, it's hard to have dogmatic. When you have a boss that's really dogmatic about that, about it's a crime, it's a violation of the law, it's sometimes hard to reconcile spending a lot of calories on something. You think, really, we're going to chase this guy down for this? Did you have a question for Todd?
So as a corporate compliance sort of looking at this from a systemic standpoint, have you seen anything, learned anything, thought anything about what draws a line between an organization where it's easy for some of these things to happen and an organization where it's much harder for that kind of rationalization to happen and let its lines get crossed?
Yeah, you do. One observation, Todd, that I've made is no one has a premium on ethics. I've worked in higher ed, law enforcement, for-profit and not-for-profit organizations. And, you know, in the media, of course, the corporate guys are always the bad guys conspiring to cheat people and take over the world. Not true. Some of the most honest, ethical leaders I've ever worked with and for were in Fortune 500 companies. Not that there wasn't bad ones. And when you think about it, a company like a U.S. Steel or a PPG or a Heinz, you know, my definition of sustainability is taking care of your customers, taking care of your investors, and taking care of your employees. And if you survive 150 years, you're doing those three things or you wouldn't be in existence. So are there what we used to call, in my when I briefed the board of directors, it was very important for me to say, this is an individual act of misconduct. Mr. Smith, you know, we had Mr. Smith and he embezzled $40,000 and here's how he did it and here's the controls we put in place. Because no one wanted to think that we had a systemic problem in a corporation where we were an unethical organization. And so I was always careful to say individual act of misconduct. He violated our policies, he violated the law, and we found him through our systems or through the hotline and we've addressed it. Because no organization and no person, frankly, that I've run into thinks of themselves as unethical. In fact, sometimes you got a tough sell with corporate executives to even talk about ethics. They want to talk about compliance. Because, of course, we're all ethical people. We know right from wrong. John wouldn't work here if he wasn't ethical. And so it was, you almost stayed away from the E word. You talked about compliance, misconduct, and sort of clinical terms. But you did have, obviously, unethical people. And I have some views of companies that I've known that I thought their ethos was not good. One local one comes to mind, I won't name it, but who's in the news a lot. I just think some of the things I've seen at that company, the people I've known that work there, both in compliance and law and operations side. I think there are companies that have a lower standard and have their priorities somewhat mixed. But it's hard to be a 100-year-old company and survive and have that sort of a systemic problem with ethical behavior. You just don't last. You know, your customers find out, your employees find out, your suppliers, your investors. It just doesn't work. Any other guess?
Are you an outlier?
I don't think so. There's, one of the things I used to say when I talked to corporate groups, there's nothing worse than a sanctimonious compliance officer. You know, the holier-than-thou guy or gal that gets up there and talks about, Mike, you know who the worst offender was? Starbucks. I hated Starbucks. They were so holier-than-thou. Their compliance guy, and this is great. A couple of, J&J, a couple other companies would always, Ford was that way. I'm just thinking of individual people that, their company was so great. I would always try to speak with humility and talk about the problems we had as a company and the ones we were fighting through and trying to get better. And to your point, it really would set people off when someone would hold them out as a paragon of virtue, hold themselves as a company out as a paragon of virtue. You know, Starbucks is one, of course. But you want to do the best job for your company. But I think it's good to humanize them with some humility. You know, we all struggle with this. We're all human beings, right? We're all sinners. And so we're all going to inevitably have problems. But I'd say, for the most part, compliance officers, are more my mindset. They know they're not perfect. A good example, Penn State, I'll talk about next week. I was so welcomed into the family of higher education compliance, if you will, which was kind of a new field when I got there. I went to my first conference, and there was a bunch of I was there 3 months, and I went to this higher ed compliance conference, and there was 300 or 400 people, compliance officers from higher ed, and presentations on Penn State, and I'm sitting here listening to all this, and finally at one of them, it was a big group, in fact, it might have been close to 1,000 people. I stood up and was agreeing with a point that the speaker had made, and I introduced myself as Penn State, and the whole audience gave me an ovation. And it was because they know, there but for the grace of God go I. And this could have happened at any school in the country. Nobody has a premium. In fact, the president of Penn State said to me after we put in all these controls, I'm stealing my thunder from next week. But one of the things he said to me was, if we'd have done everything that you said we should do and all these things we put together, there's still a high level of probability we wouldn't have caught Sandusky. Possible. I think we actually would have, maybe 01. We'd have, maybe not 98, but 01. But, you can't get too full of yourself. And to your point, I think most compliance officers know that. They're but for the grace of God go I. Whether it's a Bhopal or a Sandusky or one of these other... some people are still. I think Michigan's not behaved well in the face of Nassar. I think Penn State owned their problems pretty quickly, wrote a lot of checks. I think Michigan's been a little reluctant to step up to the plate. A lot of, it's a wonderful institution. It's a blue chip academic institution, one of the best law schools in the world, and I think they've really struggled stepping up. And I'm not even sure. I think they have a compliance department now, but it was really very reluctantly that they moved into a systemic response to Larry Nassar and all that. Other questions? Yes, sir.
So, just remind me, there's been a lot of higher education in the news and people with means. Maybe there's some ambiguity there. I don't know. I mean, you hear people speak about that. There was a heck of a lot of justification for sure going on. How does that?
You know, as I said, and I told my graduating class a few weeks ago, people are people, and higher ed's no different. They don't have any premium on ethics. A lot of them are high-minded, and you know, I think a lot of them have weak business systems. The biggest shock I got going from corporate America to Penn State was how antiquated the accounting, the business systems were, their HR systems. And so a lot of this stuff that corporate's pretty good at capturing and moving on, you know, higher ed was clueless. Penn State was making an effort to get into the 80s, you know, when I was there 5 years ago. You know, and I would tease them about it. You know, it's very antiquated because, you know, the faculty drives it, which is great. That's why we're there. We get out of bed every day because the faculty's educating students, doing research, and serving the community. But their interests are not in keeping the trains running on time. The administrators who have to do all that and the HR stuff and the business systems, you know, they've deferred for many years and didn't want to make some of these hard calls. And many of my colleagues in higher ed have told me the same thing.
So nonprofits seem to struggle with this, you know, notion of, I get the sense sometimes that we're not a business, so business practices don't apply.
Exactly.
They seem like they're maybe even further out from higher education.
And the best example of that is, and I'll talk 1 second, the best example of that is giving people honest appraisals. I would prefer a boss to sit down to me and say, Regis, here's the things you're doing well, and tick them off and say, here's your, if you want to improve in this company, you want to go, here's the things you need to do well. And so you're a 3 out of 5. You're doing everything we hired you to do, but to really exceed, you need to be better at your, you need to work a little harder. I'd like to see you more aggressive in these 3 areas. You will not see that in higher ed. I guarantee you won't see that in higher ed. There's never anything, but I had one vice president tell me, a 3 on a 5-point scale is a C. All my people are A's. I had 36 hotline calls from his organization. So there was lots of problems in that organization, but he had all A performers. It's like Lake Wobegon. Everyone's above average, right? Higher ed will not have honest conversations with their employees. And I've talked to many colleagues about this. You will not have some, and so what happened was I would end up having honest conversations with employees. But that's one of the big, and not-for-profits are not too much different. Businesses, they have their personal interest at heart, so they will groom you, they will move you up, they will get you in shape, or they will get rid of you. And that's in my benefit to do that. Because if I'm a slacker, why should they carry me? And it's not going to be in the interest of anyone else. So, yeah, Todd.
So, just what you're saying about humility and standards being something that needs attention across the board is really resonating, because I see a lot and deal with a lot of issues with scientific integrity. Whether it's nutrition research or medical research. And the assumption is that if you have an academic researcher doing work on his own without any corporate input, that you can trust that research. And if you have a food company involved in research or a pharmaceutical company in research, automatically that research is suspect.
Right.
When in truth, systematic reviews of research done by purely academic organizations and by collaborations between industry and academia shows that when industry is involved, they have to, on average, adhere to a higher standard of process and data integrity and scientific integrity. But people just automatically refuse to accept that.
Right. Right, it's difficult. And not that corporate is squeaky clean either. They've had issues.
They're data issues, but they have a lot of money at stake.
Right. And again, they won't be a sustainable organization if they're caught cheating and lying. You know, and to be sustainable, you have to toe the line. And so the researchers in institutions are almost always in, you know, they're only as good as their next grant. So that's a great incentive to do the right thing, obviously, but it's also an incentive to produce results. And sometimes they shade the truth a little bit. We had one that was sort of a combination. It was, I think I can say this out loud, Airbnb is the deadly enemy of the hotel industry.
Right.
Penn State has a huge hospitality school, and they do research in that area. They educate a lot of hospitality managers. And one of the hotel chains, or maybe a hotel organization, funded research that was very unpleasant for Airbnb about the experience of travelers, etc. And we cut some corners on the disclosures on the research. And I say we, I mean the institution, and particularly the professor that led it. And Airbnb hired a firm that was relentless in attacking us on social media and in the media, the general media, and in personal letters, and they would not let up on this. And they had a point. And we had a really tough time with this professor and their deans, because again, deans never want to tell anybody bad news. You know, it's, we just want to keep these things moving. We don't want to deal with this, you know, people. We don't have people issues. We don't have time for that. And they're not trained that way. They're trained as academic experts, and they're experts in their field, but we don't train them as managers and to institute human resource controls and so forth. So it was very difficult. We had to really fight with this dean to really get this professor, particular professor, back in line. And we had our law department involved and intellectual property folks involved in trying to sort it out. But the person put us in a very bad situation, because Airbnb's attack dogs had a very good point about the research. It was okay, but it wasn't fully disclosed about who was funding it. And there may have been some holes itself in the methodology surrounding the research. It's a tough area. I wasn't responsible directly for research integrity. We had a department that did that. But they reported to me, and I reported to the board about their efforts. And I laid awake at night a lot worrying about effort reporting, you know, how you track your time. You're not allowed to use time on one grant to be applying for another grant and those sorts of things. And, you know, there wasn't a lot of transparency there. And I remember having lunch with an FBI agent in State College very early on who said, I've been here 17 years. You've got 40,000 employees, $6 billion turnover. We've never had a single case come out of Penn State. Boy, are you guys honest. And his point was, of course, nobody is honest. 40,000 people, $6 billion. You had to have something happen here. So I always kept that in mind. Like, what's happening right now that's a problem that I'm going to have to deal with down the road? So anyway, how are we doing on time? I ran over a little bit. So thank you very much. I look forward to seeing you next week. We'll talk a little bit more.